This is The Guardian.
Hi, everybody. It's Max here. Just to say that for some reason, my recording didn't work. And I think it's probably only fair that I hold my hands up and acknowledge that I would be very critical of other panelists whose names might be Barry, if it had happened to them. So I deserve your wrath. John Bruin, Lars Sivertsen, Sid Lowe, Barry, and Susie Rack all sound great. My recording is taken from the Zoom, but hopefully they'll cut out as much of me talking as possible, and you can enjoy the rest of the pod. My humble apologies. And here it is.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Champions League, another game of two halves for Manchester United. Do almost nothing against a very Atleti for 45, but somehow find a way back. Anthony Elanga giving them a great chance of getting through. Meanwhile, an eventful evening for Sebastian Haller for Ajax, who draw with Benfica in Portugal. It might have been more, but for some questionable goalkeeping from their third choice. In the Premier League, Liverpool hit Leeds for six, close brackets. The title race is on. You start to wonder if Leeds might want to change their tactics a little bit. What is Antonio Conte on about? On Saturday, the squad were one of the best he'd ever worked with. Now he says they're always the same, and what's the point? Meanwhile, as we said, if Roy can just sort out Watford's defence, then perhaps they'll have a chance of staying up. Conceding four at home to Palace isn't quite that. Also today, England win the Arnold Clark Cup. Millie Bright is top scorer. We're going to win the Euros and everything. We'll do all that, answer your questions. There's a superb Eau Claire-inspired musical outro, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, Max.
Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Good morning, Max. How are you doing?
I'm marvellous. Thank you very much. Hello, John Bruin.
Hello, Max Rushton.
And joining us for just this bit to talk about Atleti Manchester United, which is very enthusiastic to talk about. It's Sid Lowe. Hello, Sid.
Morning, Max.
Let's start then with Atleti Manchester United. Sid, how was it?
Not very good.
Is that all you've got?
It is all I've got for a number of reasons. It's all I've got, firstly, because it's true and it wasn't very good. And secondly, because I didn't know if you pressed the stopwatch to see how long my answer was. And I was making the point that it needn't be that long.
Well, I'll tell you what. Can we start, Barry, with that header by João Felix? I mean, it was absolutely... I think the other day we were talking about people don't score diving headers anymore. It was the absolute epitome of a diving header.
Well, for my money, Max, Brentford's Ethan Pinnock now has a rival for goal of the season. I think it was that good, that header. It was. I love a diving header, and the fact he had to stretch every sinew to the absolute limit to get on the end of it. Harry Maguire made his life a little easier, but you know, you can pick on Harry Maguire for a lot. I wouldn't necessarily hold him to blame for that. It's just some goals are practically undefendable. And that was an astonishingly good header. And the fact that it went in like with a thump off the woodwork makes it all the better, I think.
Where, John, do we put it in the pantheon of diving headers?
Well, the very top is Keith Houchin, is it not?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
All that collection of ridiculously low Andy Gray headers.
Yeah. Andy Gray, I think against Sunderland, sort of 84, 85, that's a good one. Across from Trevor Stephen. So that's the level, isn't it? The 80s diving header is the very toppermost of the poppermost.
I just think the 80s is the level,
yes,
for everything,
absolutely,
isn't
Sid,
it?
I totally mean, agree.
I'm looking at the Zoom chat and thinking, I think the 80s is pretty much a sweet spot. If you're younger than us, we don't like you. Go away. It's done.
I will not stand for this. Ignoring Henrik Larsson, Euro 2004 here.
Absolutely.
Needs to be in the conversation for best of.
What about Robin van Persie against Spain?
Oh, so good. No,
that's a stupidly good header.
Well, that's like a diving header from distance, which is...
That's a lob. Yeah. It somehow makes you a lob header,
Yeah. Well, this is more your classical, as Sid says, you Andy Gray. It's not Houchin. Houchin is the big daddy of all of them. Just because it means so much for Coventry, but
sorry, Coventry.
But yeah, great header, and I suppose added artistic impression for crashing off a post, and that always adds that added element, doesn't it?
Lars, Manchester United have been terrible for first halves of games, a lot in the Champions League, and then better in the second half. Is this a Ralph Ragnick? Is this something that he's brought with him from other places to just not bother with the first 45 minutes?
I'm not aware that he has a history of just completely chucking it in the first half and then just sort of shouting at everyone at halftime to make it better in the second. But it was one of those, like, in the first half from United, you had, what was that? Like, all of it was bad. All of it was really, really bad. In terms of them not being enough intensity, it's something he brought up after the game, not looking after the ball properly when they had it. You know, Atleti were quite happy to let them have the ball, as you expect. You couldn't really do anything about it. There was also, just on an individual level, just Pogba and Bruno Fernandes and just some really technically very good players making a lot of basic mistakes, which was really weird to see.
I say this as someone who doesn't watch Man United a lot, but I was left in that position where you're sitting there talking to or turning to people who do watch them a lot and going, are they always like this?
Because
it was so bad. And well, that was the thing I wasn't so sure about, which is why I had to ask. But that was the thing, Lars, that it felt to me that these were footballers not able to do the very most basic things. Like, at one point, you got the feeling that someone had put their legs on the wrong way around. They couldn't play a pass 10 metres to each other. And it was really, I thought it was really exaggerated. In particular with Rafa Varane, who and that was quite striking to me because I've not seen much of him since he left for Real Madrid. And he was never the most elegant player in possession, because there's something about his sort of legginess that means it doesn't always look that elegant, although he's a great recovery defender, or he has been anyway. But the way they were taking their goal kick short into the area and almost getting themselves in trouble almost every time, it's just De Gea gives it to someone who then goes, oh God, now what? And there was this real sense that they couldn't do the most basic things all the way through it. I was watching Ronaldo because it's doing the sidebar on Ronaldo. And in a way, it's kind of unfair to do the sidebar on Ronaldo because everyone was so bad. But it was interesting watching Ronaldo at the top of the pitch, kind of looking back at this. And you could imagine him thinking, wow, is this it? Now, look, I don't know enough about United to get into the debate into what extent he's the guilty party or they are. But watching him watch them and kind of thinking, well, and there was a moment where this is what I was writing about. There was a moment when he kind of signaled to say, one, you know, just let me have one ball. And they just never got anywhere near him almost.
But you were just doing sort of Gogglebox. You were like watching Ronaldo, watching Paul Pogba.
Effectively, yeah. I mean, when you do a sidebar, obviously you're looking for a theme rather, because it's not the match report. And there was just no theme developing except just, wow, this is really quite bad. And of course, with the focus on Ronaldo and return and stuff, but it was quite interesting watching him watch them and the times when he would kind of wave them up the pitch, say, no, you've got to bring the team up here, and then realise that there was just no point and just sort of turn and trudge off.
There are times when you start to feel like United as a club is this sort of twilight zone of doom. Like when there was a recent M. Night Shyamalan film in which people were on a beach and they were just inexplicably aging on this beach. Now, they don't age as such at United, but you see perfectly good footballers who join the club and just suddenly, through some sort of metamorphosis that's not properly explained by the plot, they just become incapable of doing very basic footballing things that they've always been capable of doing somewhere else. It's very, very strange. But I guess the flip side of it is, they were better in the second half, a little bit. And you see again on the goal, at the end of the day, there is so many good footballers in there. Is when they suddenly remember how to play good football, they can punish you if you make mistakes. And the main takeaway from this is that, you know, it was a draw. Like, it probably shouldn't have been a draw, but it was.
I've got an apology to make to Ralph Rangnick. He made that triple substitution, didn't he? He brought on two fullbacks and Nemanja Matic, and I thought, I think I tweeted, you know, real death or glory stuff here. Now, what that managed to do actually was lock up the game a little bit, and then he brings on Elanga. Elanga appears to be something of a trump card for Rangnick, and he appears to be the type of player that fits Ralphie's system, who is someone who listens to instructions, works hard, is athletic, speedy, intelligent player as well. And when you look at the clubs that Rangnick's been involved in, you know, the Red Bull Empire, those are the type of players that they've gone for. And Elanga is that type of technical player that fits that system. And also, the fact that he changed to fullbacks, the two fullbacks being changed, that also appears to be important to Rangnick's system and the Red Bull thing. I think when you watched Leipzig, their most important player a couple of seasons ago was Angelino, who, you know, as a fullback. So there is some sort of tactical thing going on there, even if it was a wobbling, amorphous mess for such a long time.
I mean, from an athletic perspective, that goal, Sid, is disastrous. I mean, the centre-back, is it Reinaldo?
It's Reinaldo. Reinaldo, yeah.
Who's Reinaldo. New... Reinaldo dives in, like, I wonder what he's doing. And it seems like Oblak, who Mark Landon was telling me yesterday, is having a pretty average season, gave Elanga a lot of goal to put that in.
Yeah, I thought, in a way, the way the goal went in was kind of the portrait of Oblak's season. And by that, I mean that you look at it and you can't directly say Oblak was terrible, this is a terrible mistake. But you just don't have that feeling that he's going to stop it. And you just don't have that feeling that he's moving in the right direction. He kind of lies down almost, doesn't he? He's slightly out of position. The dive is sort of a fall backwards rather than a dive. And this is one of the things that's been so striking about Atleti this year, that this idea that they don't do the things they used to do well. So they're not defending well. They're conceding goals. I think yesterday that was their 35th goal this season, which is already, and actually was the best part of 4 weeks ago now, more than they conceded in the whole of last season. And it's now already more than they've conceded in any of the seasons that Simeone's been there. It's 10 years. And we've got, how long have we got left of the season? Another 3 months at least. I think that's right, isn't it? And so you're in this position where they're not doing that part of it well. But Oblak is definitely part of this, because in all of this attempt to try and explain Atletico this year, of course, you end up looking at the statistics and you use things like expected goals or shots conceded and all these kind of things. And those underlying statistics are not that bad. And so that tells you one of two things. Obviously, it tells you that, OK, so the number of shots they face might not be that high, but when it happens, they're clearer than they used to be. Or there's that little moment where they're not as and Simeone keeps using this word contundencia, which I suppose is decisiveness. You know, the ball drops in a box and someone doesn't come and go, bang, it's gone. There's that little bit of something missing. And then on top of that, there is the, it's oversimplistic, but there is the Oblak explanation. I was looking at the statistics before the game yesterday, and David De Gea against Jan Oblak. And I think David De Gea's shot save percentage was at 76, 77, I think, of the shots on target he saves. Oblak's was under 50%. Which for him is incredibly low this season. And it's incredibly low. And as I say, you look at this, and I'm struggling, and it might be that I've forgotten some, but I'm struggling to remember a moment this season where I've seen a goal and thought, that was terrible from Oblak. But the point is, there's lots of ones where you kind of go, well, maybe it could have been better. And he's just not saving them.
Barry, Mystic Baz, you're on a run of one very good predictions, which we'll get to shortly in the pod. Who do you think's going through?
On the evidence of what I saw last night, I would say Atletico. I was hugely unimpressed with Manchester United. I did know, I was watching the late night BT sort of post-mortem, and it was Michael Owen, Rio were with Jake, and they singled Marcus Rashford out for criticism, you know, and wondered where has it all gone wrong, and sort of discussed the fact maybe he's trying too hard and to just not getting the basics right because he's trying Hollywood passes and Hollywood balls all the time. And that was fair enough. But I think you could have singled any number of Manchester United players out for criticism. Paul Pogba is just a shambles of a player and needs to get out of that club, I think. He was disastrous last night. The decision to pick Victor Lindelof a right back was kind of baffling, and Atletico obviously targeted him, and that's where their goal came from and many of their opportunities came from.
Well, that's the other thing from an Atletico point of view, is so the reaction to this was that this was a good performance, and this is much more like what you want from Atletico, even if, as you say, Max, the goal was... I felt a little bit sorry for Ronaldo, because I think there's a moment in which he realises he can't quite get there, but he's got to go for it. And it's, so he's slight, it's as if he's slightly...
It was like he pressed all his buttons on his controller.
Yeah, just like, try something. Exactly, try something. Just kind of... And so the reaction to the game was one of, this was a really good performance that should have put Manchester United out of sight. And yet, actually, you look at it, you think, David De Gea saves? How many? None, I think, is the answer to that. He still didn't create enough. They should have scored the one that hit the post, although it was actually off Lindelof's face, wasn't it? And then the Griezmann one against the bar. So I think there is a sense of a kind of a positive reaction from it to it from last night, not least, of course, because the context is Atleti haven't played well this year. And so this was felt like it was a step in the right direction. But I still feel like there's not enough that's actually... They don't actually make enough happen.
Sid, you can go away now if you like.
Thank you very much. Cheerio, everybody.
Bye now. Sid Lope out in Madrid. Let's do the other game. Benfica, Ajax finished 2-2. Lars, you lead the Sebastian Haller is terrific society.
I do.
And he had quite an interesting game, didn't he?
I mean, sometimes the man is just too potent. What can I say? I mean, he's just, he cannot be stopped. He scored two goals. Unfortunately, they were in you know, different ends. I mean, ideally, you want both of them to go in the opponent's goal. In this case, you know, what he has cannot be taught, and it was just too potent, and he knocked one in the wrong end. He was goal adjacent. The ball was there to be poked, and so he duly poked it home.
He scored 14 goals in 53 games in a year and a half for West Ham. He scored 11 goals in 7 Champions League games already this season. I think he's on 28 goals for the season for club and country. So it is remarkable how he's able to perform so well for Ajax, but couldn't, you know, hit a barn door for West Ham. He says himself the £45 million price tag weighed heavily on his shoulders, but he doesn't seem to strike me as the kind of guy who would let something like that bother him. He does seem quite, you know, chilled.
I think at Ajax he benefits from having quite a few players around him. I mean, there are more attacking players who get into the box. He has players to play off, whereas he was very isolated for West Ham. And you know, Antonio thrives because he's such a like an instrument of chaos up there. You know, he can run, he barges into people, he creates things out of nothing. Whereas Allaire, you know, he's not the fastest, he can't really dribble past people, he's good in the air, but he definitely thrives on having players around him that he can play off, and he has that much more at Ajax.
The Dusan Tadic finish was absolutely beautiful, wasn't it? You wonder, though, with Juranovic's equaliser, John, that the Ajax keeper, Remco Pasveer, will be disappointed with himself. He really looks like that guy who plays in goal because he can't do it on the pitch anymore, and he still likes hanging around with the lads, you know, sort of grey hair and a ponytail. I enjoy him being there, yeah.
He looks like Jimmy Bullard, doesn't he? It's like Jimmy Bullard's decided to go in goals. Yeah, I looked him up before I know he's played for PSV and was at Vitesse as well, was before that. But journeyman goalkeeper, I think this guy, maybe the new definition of that. And obviously, he's come into the team because Ajax's other two goalkeepers have got injury problems. Though, I think, isn't Stekelenburg older than him even?
Yeah, he's also incredibly old.
Yeah, so I was trying to see if he also had a sort of top-knot greying ponytail. That would be good. Just obviously, I'd go watch the Manchester United game. I watched the highlights of this game. And Lars is better qualified, of course, to talk about this. But the thing that I liked about this game, the absolute speed these two teams played at and attacked at, it almost felt like a throwback in the fact that you would watch a European game and see two teams who just threw the kitchen sink at it. You know, compare that to Atletico, Man United, almost like a totally different sport. And great to watch, and you know, I'd love Tadic. I think he's such a great player. And there's one of those things, isn't it? With him and Haller, you know, you leave the Premier League, and people think, oh right, that's over for them. But then you join a club like Ajax, and you have a chance to compete on the highest European stage and play great football. You could see why it might be attractive to a few players.
Yeah, and on the subject of players who have left the Premier League, and you think that's it for them. Adel Taarabt starting in central midfield for Benfica, having sort of really
Absolutely.
Had some kind of the most unexpected yeah. Indian summer of any career, I think.
Yeah, the sort of Jens Jeremies of Benfica.
I did,
yeah.
in a rare Lars inside info, and I did speak to someone who knows him quite well, who said that he's just really like sorted his life out a little bit in Lisbon and has a different focus and maybe just sort of realizes that this is kind of it. Like, he's 32 now. If he doesn't, you know, get it together now, that there's not much left in this career, and that he's a little bit more on it. And he's doing a good job there. But as to what you were saying, John, I completely agree. I mean, it was so end-to-end, this game. And I guess that's what you get when you have two teams who, you know, whether they have the inclination to shut the other team down, I don't know, but they certainly don't have the ability. I don't think either of these could, like, just really stop an opponent and, like, stop them from playing. Maybe Ajax can press a bit more effectively, but definitely two teams who are better on the front foot, and that massively showed.
It's worth mentioning Yaremchuk. When he scored the goal, he took off his shirt to reveal the Ukrainian coat of arms. And on that note, a word to our listeners in Ukraine. We are not big in Ukraine, but we had 110 weekly listeners over the last 7 days. I don't imagine any of you are listening to this pod, but if you are, just for some respite, our thoughts are with you. And wherever you are, we hope you are safe and that you are all still here to listen to the pod when the war is over. I don't know if that is in any way helpful or useful, but I just thought it'd be worth saying to our listeners in Ukraine.
Sorry, it will be interesting, Max, to see if Roman Yaremchuk is receives additional punishment for UEFA for showing off that Ukrainian trident on his T-shirt, this being UEFA, who take £30 million a year from Gazprom as their main sponsors. So, yeah, that's one to follow, I think.
Yes, you expect they'll be having meetings at UEFA about things, but it will be very interesting if, as we said yesterday, not the most important part of all this, to find out what they decide to do with the Champions League final. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll cover the Premier League. Welcome to part two with the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start at Anfield then. Liverpool 6. Leeds 0, emphatic victory. Hey, Liga, there is league. 6 goals is always great, Barry, isn't it? Two of them were really good fun. Joel Matip wandering up. Arvin says, is Joel Matip Cameroon's Beckenbauer? And the fourth goal was lovely as well. Do you consider this a statement victory?
Not really. It's a pretty routine victory, I think. I didn't give Leeds much hope in this game. I thought, ahead of the Manchester United game, I honestly thought they might beat Manchester United. I wasn't convinced they'd do particularly well here, and they duly got swatted aside. They're in a major trouble now, and, you know, right in the relegation scrap. But clinical finishing by Liverpool. They put away most of their chances. Fabinho missed one he should have scored, so it could have been worse. But yeah, I really enjoyed that Matip goal where he realised, oh, I could just go wherever I want and play the give and go with, I think it was Salah, and then finished when he got the return ball came his way. But statement victory, not so much. I think there was a different statement victory last night in the three games. But yeah, a routine win, I would say.
Danny tweeted me before the game kicked off to say, he's a Leeds fan, why were we so wide open for all of Liverpool's goals tonight? Rob says, can we actually have a discussion about Leeds being relegated? It's usually, quote, they'll have enough to stay up, but we won't. We are the worst team in the division. John, what do you make of Leeds' plight?
There's always a team that drops down. And I think a few of us have eyed Everton. A few of us have eyed Brentford. But hey, Leeds, it's your turn. I think a team that struggles to score goals and can't defend is always going to have problems, he said rather tritely. And they offered zero resistance, it would appear, to Liverpool. There was a nice picture that I sent around to the group last night of Marcelo Bielsa and his translator. And the translator on a still, and you know, maybe this wasn't a reflection of what actually happened, just had his head in his hands, which, you know, may well be him acting out Marcello's words to the letter. But yeah, I mean, listen, it's possible, isn't it? They've had a lot of injuries. They are a thin squad anyway. They can't defend. The teams below them are slowly picking up. It's highly possible. I suppose, you know, in mitigation for Leeds and for a bit of sympathy is that they didn't get to enjoy that first season with the fans in the stadium, which, you know, would have been great for all those Leeds fans. And then the season when they do get to see them, it's been a bit of a grind for them. And listen, Bielsa's been a real good thing to have in the Premier League. Really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed watching Leeds games. They allow the opposition to play. They play well themselves sometimes. But it does seem a little bit naive and a bit idealistic for the grim, gritty Premier League that we so love.
Don't you think, Lars, I do wonder, we all love Bielsa because he's different and he has done something miraculous with this team. Yeah, it doesn't seem particularly objective if we don't ever criticise him for going into games where tactically it seems really naive to do what he's doing.
No, that's fair. I just, you know, it's not games against Liverpool. And I know that's a local, Man United is a local derby for them, and it's a sort of rivalry, so it's quite passionate. It's not really games against these top teams where their season is decided. I know losing 6-0 to Liverpool is demoralising and no fun, but losing to Newcastle is a much bigger problem for Leeds, really. We got a question, a quite aggressive question on this. You know, Bielsa finally exposed for the myth that he is. Was one. You do get those occasionally. I think this sort of man-marking thing he does is strange. And when we talk about Bielsa's influence on coaches, like, no one's really taken aboard this sort of extreme man-marking thing, because basically I'm not sure it's a sensible way of doing it, because it can go spectacularly wrong, and it does do so very often. All of which being said, Leeds is suffering a lot from, like, Calvin Phillips not being around, from Cooper not being there, from Bamford not being there. You know, a lot of teams, if you take out the captain in defence, the sort of linchpin in midfield and the one good striker they have, a lot of teams would struggle, Jeff, for me. But currently things are bad. We have to say that.
If Bielsa could wave a magic wand, the mythical figure he is, I suspect whoever asked the question probably meant fraud rather than myth. A lot of people seem to think he's a fraud. And could have one of those players back guaranteed to be fit for the rest of the season, Cooper, Phillips or Bamford. Who do you think he would pick? I reckon Phillips.
Phillips, yeah. I think the role he plays in midfield for them as the sort of ball winner and the guy who plays those sweeping sort of big diagonals out to the wingers, you know, God bless Adam Forshaw. There's no shortage of effort there, but he just isn't the same player and he's not going to be.
Burnley 1, Spurs 0. John says, this falls alongside Brentford beating Arsenal on the opening day as something Barry predicted with certainty when he knows he knows. Although, to be fair, Baz, you didn't suggest Conte might consider quitting after the game. Mohammed said, has anybody on the panel accepted a job that they very soon regretted ever accepting? I mean, it's probably worth me reading out what Antonio Conte said after the game. I came here to help the club, and if the problem could be the coach, I'm ready to go. No problem. I'm not used to this situation. I'm trying everything, but the situation is not changing. I'm available and open with the club to do what the club wants. I want to help the club. I work a lot. I work very hard. I am giving 20 hours a day to Tottenham, and the other 4 hours I sleep, but it is not enough. The performance can be good, and the commitment was good, but we lost. For me, the situation is unacceptable. I need to talk to the club. Tottenham have to make an assessment about the club, about me. We need to find the best solution. I can't accept to keep losing. I'm sorry. Seems quite extreme after a sort of windy, rainy 1-0, quite Spursy defeat to Burnley, Barry.
I suppose you have to factor into the equation that Antonio Conte is a famously emotional Italian man. And on Football Focus last Saturday, I watched Football Focus for the first time in God knows how long, but he was interviewed and he said, you know, every time a team of mine lose, I die. I die for at least 24 hours. And, you know, there's no consoling him whatsoever. I will be interested to see. He will presumably do a press conference tomorrow, Friday, ahead of Tottenham's game against Leeds. Big game. That's going to be an interesting one. And after he's had, you know, 24 hours to reflect, or 36 hours to reflect, he may change his tune. But the interesting thing is, he came out with all that stuff in his post-match interview on television. Then, as is customary, he will have done his radio interviews. And I heard on TalkSport, Sam Matterface interviewed him and immediately scuttled up to talk to the guys who were presenting in the studio and say he thought Conte was about to quit. And then he did the newspaper interviews and he was still saying the same thing. So in that sort of 40-minute post-match period, he had three sets of interviews and was peddling the same hand-wringing line in each one. So that's kind of interesting. He didn't sort of get gradually calmer as each set of interviews occurred. I don't think he would leave because it would be very embarrassing for him to leave after 4 months. But if you would have to imagine, if any team is going to break him, it's Tottenham.
I think it's worth picking apart what he's saying. The whole line about, you know, at Tottenham the coach has changed, but the players are the same and the results are the same. Like, who is he talking about? Like, if you look at the team here against Burnley, I think we can agree it's not Kane or Son's fault here, really. And if you look at the rest of the team, you've got Kulusevski and Bentancur who just arrived. Emerson Royal might well be part of the problem, but he's only been there since the summer. So again, he's not seen coaches come and go. Sessegnon is a reserve left back who was at Hoffenheim last season. So again, doesn't really fit the bill. Højbjerg's been there for a year and a half, so maybe a little bit. Romero just came. I mean, Lloris drops the odd clanger, but he's a good goalkeeper. Conte said Dier. He said before the Christmas that Dier could be one of the best players in the world in his position, so I guess he likes him. So are we saying that everything is Ben Davis's fault? That feels harsh to me, honestly. Like, is he really just going, Ben Davis, you slightly inoffensive Welshman, this is all on you? I mean, it's a very strange thing. There's a lot of people on social media who's like, yeah, right on, you know, Conte's telling it like it is. It's clearly nonsense what he's saying. And he's just a very emotional man who struggles to control himself, I guess, after games.
So you've got this highly emotional Italian man, as Barry correctly termed him. You've got this highly emotional football club that oscillates from boom to bust. I think these two are made for each other.
It's great for the content, isn't it?
So there's no part of anyone that everyone just thinks this is. He was furious and just was just like, "Oh, sod it! I'll just say what I think." That there's no part of anyone thinking he's trying to be clever to think ahead to the summer where Daniel Levy will eventually say, "Here's £1 billion."
But if he's thinking that, he is even madder than we thought.
I mean, he's a total idiot. They don't have the money. Where's the money?
It's not going to happen. So, you know, I mean, maybe that's how he takes out his frustrations. And it is interesting, you know, Barry says that he gave the same interview across the press. And that's one thing you do learn if you cover matches now and again, is that all those great lines that you think, wow, he's really laid it out there, then they say it again and again, and you think, oh, okay, they've planned for this. There's several of these, you know, like Ian Holloway was, you know, you'd think, wow, where has he pulled that from? And then he'd say exactly the same to the next person down the row. So, you know, he has planned that. Somewhere amidst that outburst, there is some method to it.
And meanwhile, Barry, Burnley actually played in this game and won. And did quite well. You know, they confined a Tottenham who'd torn Manchester City apart to virtually nothing, scored a classic Burnley goal, and as Milk's gone off, says Sean Dyche is doing it again, isn't he? Would this survival be his greatest achievement as Burnley manager?
It would be a fine achievement, and Burnley really do need to stay up from a financial point of view. If they go down, it could be a very long time before we see them again in the Premier League. I was worried we were going to move on to Watford Palace without giving Burnley any credit, which is something we've been guilty of in the past. But, you know, it would be unfair to say Tottenham had chances in the game. I think it was Harry Kane shouldered one off the bar from a Son cross, and Kulusevski shot wide with a half decent effort, but Burnley were well worth their win. I must confess, I only saw highlights of this game because there was a lot of football on last night and war broke out, so slightly frazzled and up late watching, trying to play catch up with everything. But just from dead balls and crosses, Burnley were quite lethal. Ben Mee's header was brilliant. Hugo Lloris had to make a couple of saves, and Jay Rodriguez stabbed one over the bar from close range when scoring looked easier. So two wins in a row for Burnley. They're on an upward trajectory, and it's a bit early to say they're going to pull off a great escape, but they're certainly giving themselves a very good chance.
Jordan says, should Watford look to bring in a new manager to shake things up? I think I did say on the pod, you know, look, Watford have got some good players going forward. If they can just tighten things up, then they've got a chance. That they didn't tighten things up. I mean, they had chances at 1-1 and at 2-1 to Palace, but conceding four goals to Crystal Palace is not great. This is for Crystal Palace's first win of 2022. Conor Gallagher's goal, John, was beautifully taken, wasn't it?
Yeah. Technique, calm. There's a player that plays with such confidence, doesn't he? That swagger. You could see Conor Gallagher playing in the 1980s, socks rolled down, medallion swinging in the wind, aftershave wafting as he struts his stuff. He's a proper South London geezer, isn't he? And he is a very good player, and yet another of those Chelsea players that are around and about. And I imagine that Chelsea are looking forward to having him in the team next season. Watford, oh dear. That was a good win for them at the weekend, and this was a very bad performance. It just caught a camera shot of Roy. And when Roy Hodgson looks displeased, the whole world knows, don't they? And he did really look very annoyed with himself.
Roy Hodgson maybe needs to find some of his sort of wild man streak, the wild crazy streak that he had when he worked in Norway as manager of Viking. Slightly related to Antonio Conte. I mean, he once sort of, in inverted commas, quit in the dressing room, Hodgson, after a particularly bad game when he was in charge of a club in Norway. And he just said that he was off, and the players weren't sure if he was joking or not. And for a couple of hours, there was total confusion around the club as to whether Roy Hodgson had resigned or not. Maybe he needs to employ this sort of strategy to rattle the Watford players a little bit.
The thing is, though, Lars, a manager leaving a club isn't going to shock any Watford player, is it? So.
Just, I guess, another one goes.
Also, Lars, it sounds like you're giving Roy and Antonio Conte very different... You know, you're saying Roy should threaten to leave all the time, yeah, and saying Antonio Conte isn't allowed to threaten to leave. But maybe
it's possible Roy I was being be... entirely flippant and just using this as yet another excuse to bring up something Scandinavian for no reason at all.
Perhaps you're just a myth, Lars.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe that is it. Anyway, the other thing I noticed from this game, which won't really make any Watford fans happy, is just how much everybody loves Moussa Sissoko. Like, when he scored that goal, he was embraced by every Watford player, every Watford player on the bench, every part of the coaching staff. Everybody wanted to pat the head of Moussa Sissoko. So like, even if they do get relegated, they all have a friend. So what's more important, you know, friendship or relegation, or staying in the Premier League? I'll take
it's probably staying in the Premier League if you're Watford.
Probably is, you're right. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Arsenal play Wolves tonight, by the way. So good luck to both sides, and that'll do for part two. Susie Rack joins us for part three. We look back at England's historic win in the Arnold Clark Cup. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Susie Rack, the Guardian women's football correspondent, joins us live from a hotel in Wolverhampton. How are you, Susie?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad.
So, look, England 3, Germany 1. England win the Arnold Clark Cup. We're going to win the Euros, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, such a prestigious and historic trophy. And it means so much to the players to collect it at this key moment in time.
Arnold Clark, the saviour we never knew.
women's football needed. But look, it's been. I mean, the performances have been really impressive, haven't they? To be unbeaten against these three sides. This is the first ever home victory over Germany as well. There's a lot of positivity that have come from these games.
Yeah, it's only the second win over Germany in 27 attempts, I think it is. So it's a big deal. I mean, Germany had a lot of players missing. I think about 12 were out through injury, COVID, various things, quite key players. But they're still an incredibly strong side. You know, the starting 11s they put out were really, really good teams. Canada, meanwhile, most of their players play in the US. The US is in its off-season. So again, they're not, you know, kind of maybe the fullest of strengths, but it's still, you know, the old saying, you can only play who's in front of you, can't you? And England have played a lot of teams in World Cup qualifying that they've absolutely smashed. So to actually get three games against top 10 nations was really important. And there were some really, really positive signs. I mean, like, the two goals conceded were like world beaters, whereas usually we're sort of used to complete and utter defensive chaos. And, you know, that's a positive to take away from it. And then there was, you know, some really nice signs that some of the different things that Serena Wiegmann was trying out were working, like Kira Walsh and Leah Williamson as a double six, and things like that. So it's positive. The Euros is another kettle of fish, but it's a good start on that road.
It seems, and this may be a controversial take, that Serena Wiegmann is a better fit for the England women's team than Phil Neville was.
I feel sorry for Phil. He was very good at building relationships with the players, and really, really good at building a sort of family around the team. But he's not a very good coach, which was the problem. And Serena Wiegmann is an elite level coach. I mean, she's worked under the best. She went to the University of North Carolina and played under Anson Durant, who led the US women's national team to their first ever World Cup in 91 and masterminded the winning mentality and the formula, has got so many players to where they are today. Like, I think he's coached a third of US women World Cup winners, and like Lucy Bronze and players like that. So, you know, she's got a really strong track record, and obviously won a home Euros with the Netherlands, got them to a final of the World Cup. So she knows what she's doing a little bit more, comes in with a little bit more experience than poor Phil.
Very diplomatic, Susie. I like that. It was that picture that you tweeted out of Millie Bright sharing the golden boot with Alexia Putellas is a wonderful shot. What was Minnie Bright doing up there in the 84th minute? Because had she gone up front, or was she just sort of like Joel Matip last night as well, just wandering about doing what she wanted?
No, it was deliberate. It was a conscious decision. Wiegmann told us afterwards that they needed an extra body up top, and so Leah Williamson slotted back into defence, and they put Millie up top because they know, well, as Wiegmann said, they know she's good with her head in the air, but she's also good with the ball at her feet, and it worked. I mean, I'm not quite sure it's the strategy that the FA necessarily thought they would see when they got Wiegmann in to take charge, that they would see their sort of kind of at that time much criticised centre-back being played as a striker, but it worked.
Is Wiegmann doing, you know, different things and better things with the same players? Has she brought in new players? But what changes has she made?
I think it's mostly positional and formational, but then she's also kind of early on in her tenure had a whole spate of like injuries to England players off the back of the Olympics. So many of the Team GB England players struggled with injury. You know, she's sort of been forced into a situation where she's been able to test out some of the newer players a little bit more and some new partnerships. So, I mean, the fact that Steph Horton is out and, you know, is generally a stalwart in the team, was generally considered perhaps the better of the two between Bright and herself when they played, but hasn't played under Wiegmann yet because she's still out injured, having aggravated the injury she picked up in the summer. It's going to be extremely difficult for her to get back in the team now. Like, I mean, she brings a lot leadership-wise, but the quality of the people that have played centre-back over the past 6 days, for example, like there's been 5 or 6 players that have been used in that position and have rotated across the back line. Jess Carter, Rachel Daly, like players that don't usually play there, who have performed really, really well. And that's and you've still got Lotta Wubbamoy, who's been out injured just for this camp. So like actually there's like a wealth of options in that position, whereas before there perhaps wasn't sort of many obvious choices. And I think like she's just tweaked things a little bit and tested a lot of people in different positions and has been working on the relationships. And I think the on-field relationships, I think that's been really, really important.
Moving away from this, Gulliver got in touch to say, will the pod talk about the equal pay settlement between US soccer and the USWNT players, or will they ignore it because of their anti-American bias? I think we covered our anti-American bias yesterday. We went big on American players. So, yeah, members of the US women's soccer team have reached a landmark agreement with their governing body to end a 6-year legal battle over equal pay. The deal promises them $24 million plus bonuses that match those of the men. What have you made of how long it's taken, but the verdict as well?
Oh, I mean, it's a joke it's taken this long, really, in that, you know, they are like... The biggest argument against equal pay that is trotted out is always, oh well, when a team brings in as much revenue as the men's game, then they can have equal pay. And the US have been doing that for quite some time, for a number of years at least, and outperform the men's team so consistently on the world stage, it's not even a comparison. I mean, it's a great result, and like well deserved. Has been a long time coming. There's still like quite a long way to go. You know, you look at the coaches and the I can't remember his name, the head coach of the men's team, because I barely follow men's football anymore, earns is the highest paid player, highest paid person in US soccer, and Vlatko Andronovski, the manager of the women's team, earns about 370,000 ish. And the disparity is huge. It's like 10 times less or something. Yet he is a manager of the World Cup winning side. So there's still like a long way to go across various parts, and they've still got to reach a collective bargaining agreement before this deal actually comes into play. But it's good signs that the Federation are actually starting to take them a little bit more seriously. And also, it's great for like just equality campaigns beyond football as well, because it's a real statement, you know, equal pay for equal work. Like it's a real, like, this is what should be happening statement that can be pointed to by other national teams and, you know, other just campaigners for pay equality generally.
And the US are playing in the She Believes Cup. How's that gone? I read somewhere that, you know, the Arnold Clark Cup has taken something away from the She Believes Cup. I don't know if that's nonsense. I've always thought that the She Believes Cup and Arnold Clark Cup can coexist merrily.
I mean, it's certainly rivaling it for the best name of any friendly competition that's ever existed. It's actually been a really good tournament. It's not had the same calibre of teams as it usually has in it. Perhaps it's fair to say, in that a lot of the European clubs like England, and that's the decision, part of the reason that England decided to sort of kind of arrange the hosting of the Arnold Clark Cup, was because they've got the Euros in the summer, and, you know, they all want to play on European soil, they all want to play European teams, they want to, you know, kind of prep for that tournament. And travelling across the US was very, like, the She Believes is very much a tournament set up to help the US women's national team prepare for international competition. It's not really set up to help others. It's quite a heavy schedule of travelling usually. Last time, just pre-pandemic, it was Orlando, New York, and then down to Dallas, and was a real, like, you know, kind of travel, play, travel kind of trip. But it's been really good. And like the team that have perhaps impressed me the most, surprisingly, is the Czech Republic, who they've not won a game, but they've drawn two and lost one. But they perform really well, and they've got some really nice, like, tricky players that I didn't really know they had, or wasn't really expecting them to do particularly well at all. So yeah, the US have, you know, naturally dominated, but it's been far more interesting than I think people maybe would have thought it would be.
Susie, Michaela Moore scored her hat-trick of own goals on Sunday and was the subject of some derision, let's say, on social media. Has she spoken about that since, or is she keeping the head down? I mean, it was very unfortunate, but that could be have a catastrophic effect on her career, or she may just see the funny side in a while and bounce back fine.
Yeah, no, she's not said anything yet, and I think she probably won't. I imagine that that New Zealand and Liverpool will be fairly protective of her saying anything. But I mean, the reaction was really mixed. There was real like defensive like wall put up by the women's football community, which I thought was a little bit ridiculous because it was slightly hilarious to score a perfect hat trick of own goals, the perfect hat trick. But it was, yeah, I mean, it's not an easy thing to get over. You'd like to think that, that you know, she'll just brush past it and move on. You know, it's not much that could go worse from there. At least it was just in a friendly. But I think that the frustrating thing is that, like, when a men's player makes a mistake like that, or a big error in some way, or fumbles the ball into their own net, or kicks it out, like, kicks a goal kick out for a corner or whatever it may be, it's not really, it's picked up on, it's joked about, but it's brushed over pretty quick. It doesn't bring the whole kind of value of the game into question, which is what happens every time, you know, there's like some kind of massive error made in the women's game. So there's always this sort of weight of expectation and the reputation of the game on the shoulders of any women's player that makes a mistake, because it then becomes a meme that is used around every opportunity to say women should get back in the kitchen and not play football. So that's the hard part, I suppose, that a lot of the men's players who make silly mistakes don't have to deal with in the same way, is that, you know, you kind of are maligned for damaging the reputation of women's football. Yeah, hopefully she gets over it pretty quick.
It's interesting you say that, because I've just written a column about this, because we spoke about this on Monday, but it didn't go out. I've just written a column about this because I tweeted, wow, this is tremendous. Somebody scored a hat-trick of own goals, and a lot of people agreed with that. And then some people told me, you know, to be kind and do better and all these things. And I was saying, well, actually, you should be able to laugh at a hat-trick of own goals. But then obviously a lot of people who came to my defence were also saying, women's football is rubbish and you can't laugh at anything anymore. And then I'm like, I don't want to become the mouthpiece of, you know, I don't mean the Joe Rogan of this, you know, culture war.
It's difficult, isn't it? There's no nuance on social media anymore, is there? It's very black and white. You're either one side of the fence or the other. There's no room for enjoying something for what it is. And like my reaction was similar to yours. This is insane and slightly hilarious. And, you know, like, in a way, that's a better tribute to women's football than to point out the either or sides of things, because it's treated in exactly the same way you would do a really silly, funny circumstance in the men's game. And so for me, that's the instinct. But yeah, social media doesn't leave much room for nuance and the middle ground.
Ink Hromo on Instagram, INKHROMO. Who said, morning, a long time listener to the pod, big Philippe Auclair fan, although aren't we all? The opportunity to score Monsieur Auclair's dulcet tones was too good to pass up. I hope you enjoy this quick tune. It will be cracking to hear it on the pod one day. Perhaps Rabiot was meant for radio all along. P.S. I'm eternally grateful for what good the pod has done to clear my head the past few years. Thanks to the whole lot of you. Cheers, Dom.
I sometimes think I love Philippe Auclair more than anything else.
Why is the sky blue? I don't be surprised anymore.
It's okay.
This guy's fine.
I could speak for a long time about
Beautiful stuff, Dom. Thank you so much for that. We loved it. Very upbeat competition for Liam McClare. But for the time being, thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thanks, Susie.
Cheers, Max.
Thanks, John.
Cheers, Max.
We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.